Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. If we all tried harder, could we eliminate hunger immediately? An estimated 805 million people worldwide don't have enough to eat, and nearly 5 million children die of malnutrition every year. But get this, compounding the tragedy of those statistics is the fact that the world currently grows enough food to nourish an additional 3 billion people, but fully 30% of what we produce is thrown away. Thursday is UN World Food Day for 2014, and it's designed to be a day of action against hunger. Joining us to talk about action against food waste is science journalist Elizabeth Reut, whose story in the current issue of National Geographic magazine is called The High Cost of Food Waste. Elizabeth, welcome back to Think.
Thank you.
A third of the food produced globally is never eaten. How much is that by volume?
It's a lot of pounds. It's 2.8 trillion pounds.
Wow. And how does the United Nations quantify food production and food use?
That's a very good question. The numbers are all estimates. There hasn't been a lot of transparency in this area. There are better numbers in developed nations where production is measured on the farm, and then surveys have been done about what people throw out, what people buy, and what people throw out. But a lot of it is self-reporting on the part of individuals, so there's always some wiggle room in there. So the FAO and the USDA, which does its own data collection, are always spreading caveats around that the numbers are estimates and likely to be underestimates of the amount of food that is not being consumed.
So it turns out that some of the food is lost and some of it is wasted. Can you give some more detail about the difference between those terms?
Sure. So there's a very long supply chain between the farm and your refrigerator or a restaurant. There's all these different stages from farm to post-harvest to processing to distribution to retail and then consumers. And what loss is used to talk about upstream waste on the farm and post-harvest, and they use the word waste to talk about food that has already gotten to a retailer and then the consumer. So in the U.S., we waste 133 billion pounds of food a year, and that is only counting the food from plate waste in restaurants and consumers.
Wow.
And it's a huge number, and it's mostly on this back end. In developing nations, most of the loss occurs upstream before it gets to consumers, and there's various reasons for that.
So what kinds of improvements could allow food in the developing world to get eaten before it goes bad, which is the real problem?
Yeah. Right. So the problem in the developing world is infrastructure and communication and capacity and training also. A lot of attention has been paid to farmers increasing their yields, but not as much attention was paid to teaching farmers how to deal with these new surpluses they have that they're now moving to market. So the problems are inadequate roads to get things to market. Things are grown out in the rural areas to these growing cities, but a lot of people are moving to cities. Food has to travel farther on inadequate roads and rail. Lack of refrigeration, no way to keep this food cold. And really basic things like storage crates for tomatoes or for mangoes. People were just shoving them into sacks and they would be this mushy, sticky mess by the time they got to market. And so some government bodies and NGOs and environmental groups are working on giving smallholder farmers these tools that they need, giving them small storage sheds and grain silos, giving them these reusable plastic crates to better pack their produce, teaching them the importance of keeping things cool, setting up rural cooperatives so people can pool their dairy and keep it cold and share the expense of keeping things cold before they can make their cheeses and other dairy products.
It's remarkable to think that solutions that simple and ultimately, some of these things, you give somebody a metal silo once, it's going to last for some time. Those could make really a significant difference.
Yeah, they've made a significant difference already. Let's see, there's some statistics. Well, in Afghanistan, the country was losing 50% of its tomatoes until they got these packing crates, and now losses have been shrunk down to 5% of the crop. And with the grains, I think that they cut losses by 20% with those silos. There's a lot of these examples that the FAO collects.
And, of course, better storage means better quality food for sale, and that means higher profits potentially for people who are growing these foods in the developing world.
Right. And you hit it upon an important point. The food mold and fungi are a big problem with storing grain over time. So teaching people to protect their crops from insects and rodents and from the weather is really important. But farmers were selling grain that had high levels of infestation, and people were still buying it, but it wasn't very nutritious. So taking care of the crop, not just moving it, is really important. And yes, a lot more people can be fed and get a lot more food into the market, and maybe it would keep prices lower when there's more of it.
Does it make a difference, Elizabeth, if farmers are trained to grow varieties that might be more stable? For example, I've heard that the reason we get the same kind of bananas in every U.S. grocery store is that they travel well. There are lots of other types out there, but these are the ones that sort of make the trip.
Right. So are you asking about...
Would that help in the developing world if farmers were given access to seeds for varieties of crops that are basically a little more shelf-stable?
That's an interesting question, because they didn't have to keep their crops shelf-stable before. They didn't grow that much, and it was subsistence. They were eating it on their own. So now it's a whole new world for farmers who grow more and can move it to market or need to move it to market. And I read something recently about the potential for genetically modified crops that will last longer and have more stability. Farmers used to grow varieties that did well in their climate and resisted their pests. But it's not the same thing as having long shelf life.
Hmm. Are there alternatives? We should talk now about how the developed world wastes food, because I think people might hear that figure that it's about a third of everything and think, well, I don't throw out a third of what comes into my house. But a lot of it happens before we ever buy it, right?
Yeah, a lot does happen there. But if you made a pie chart of losses in the U.S., the biggest chunk of it would be at the retail and consumer. And farmers do a pretty good job of getting most of their crops out of the field and getting them distributed. There's plenty of refrigeration. There's great communications and road networks and things like that. But yeah, if you ask anyone, do you waste food? They're going to say, no, never. I'm really good about it. But the garbage can doesn't lie, and the compost bucket doesn't lie. A lot of it is lost. So on the pie chart, 21% is just the consumer level. Of all the food wasted in the U.S., 21% of it is in our homes.
And that is, a few bites left over in a bowl that we didn't finish, and it's an apple that we let go bad. And then what about, does that count things that we trim away? You know, people buy broccoli and they don't eat the stalk, they just eat the tops. Does that count?
When the USDA does its surveys, they don't count things that are inedible. So they're not counting the cantaloupe rind or the avocado pit. I'm not sure about the stem of a broccoli, like if how much of it they measure, you know, the bottom dry part or like 5 inches up.
Right.
There's so many. Yeah, it's complicated. But yes, it is those sources that you mentioned. It's also, I should include, it's plate waste in a restaurant. It's not the behind the kitchen waste. It's plate waste. And it's also a major cause of food waste in the home is misreading labels on food. It's a huge problem. The Best Buy or Use Buy that you see on many containers of food are very rough guidelines, but people feel that they're going to get sick and die if they eat food, 5 minutes past the date. And it's absolutely not true. And revamping that whole system and educating people, or changing the system so that people don't have to wonder about it, would go a long way toward reducing food waste and these purges of the cabinets and the fridge.
Yeah, this has been a real push for the Natural Resources Defense Council, interestingly, which has mounted a campaign to kind of clear up the confusion. Tell us about those dates and what they mean. And it doesn't mean that like the yogurt became deadly yesterday when the when the date expired. Are there some guidelines to know that maybe something that has a date that looks expired is okay?
As I understand it, the dates were first used to help people who stock the shelves in groceries rotate their stock and move the older things toward the front. And I'm not exactly sure how it got to the, well, I guess, and manufacturers like the best before because they want, they've designed their processed foods to have a peak. There's a time when the taste is at its peak, and a day after that it might, or a week after it might not be at its peak, but it's still perfectly nutritious, tasty, and, you know, healthful. It's not going to make you sick and not going to taste bad either. And I think that the NRDC that you mentioned, Dana Gunders is the scientist there working on these issues, and she's very big on looking at the food and smelling it and letting that be your guide.
The way that our ancestors have done for thousands of years.
Exactly.
And of course, it's no, you know, it's no disadvantage to the food companies if we're throwing things away and buying more. They don't care whether we eat them or not.
Right. They're done with it after we bought it.
Something else that's interesting about American consumers in particular is that we are picky about our produce. And it's not just a matter of rejecting like a peach with a bruise on it. We also don't want a cucumber that has a weird bend in it because we think of cucumbers as being a particular shape.
I think that American consumers are a little more liberal than... So it's the USDA sets these standards. It's like a, you know, beauty pageant rules. And I looked them up and looked at all the different curves of cucumbers that are acceptable. And there's different grades of cukes. And the, you know, the primest cukes have very little curve. And stores are so competitive. And they're trying to differentiate each other. And they want to have the best looking stuff. And so there are these grades of food that come out of the field. And produce is culled as it comes out of the farm. It's sorted into these different grades. And then, you know, the high-end markets will take the best. And then there's secondary markets and third that are less picky. But the farmers get more money for the higher grades. And, you know, at a farmer's market, people, consumers are much more liberal about what they want. That when the farmer sells directly to a consumer, they're not doing these culls. They're putting out what they've grown, and I think that people are much more accepting of blemishes and curves and various kinds of marks. It's real life.
What are the reasons for the FDA saying that there's only this much acceptable curve to a cucumber? It does not affect the healthfulness and the nutrient quality. So why is that even a thing?
I wish I knew more about that. It's the USDA, not the FDA.
Oh, excuse me, USDA.
Yeah, I think some of it has to do with the number of units of food that fit into a box and things that are too curved. You'll have fewer. I wish I could speak more knowledgeably about it. I don't know the genesis. I tried to find out and ran into a wall there.
Well, one thing that you discovered was that sometimes food comes from the field. It's perfectly fresh. It gets packaged up, but it's packaged incorrectly. And so instead of going onto a refrigerated truck, it goes straight to a dump truck.
Yeah. I was in the Salinas Valley and visiting the fields of some grower packers. They do a lot of the lettuces and, you know, spring greens and mixes and things that are pre-packed, ready to eat. They're washed and bagged. And, you know, beautiful fields. It was great seeing all this beautiful food. But then I visited a transfer station where dump trucks come in all during the growing season, April to November, dropping off tons and tons of these lettuces in boxes and in bags that had been mislabeled. They come out of an amazing contraption. They're all in a row, and they need to be sliced, separated into their individual things. And so if they're sliced a little bit wrong, but they're still perfectly enclosed, they get dumped if they have the wrong date stamp on them. So that was pretty surprising to me.
My guest is science journalist Elizabeth Reut. Her article in the current issue of National Geographic magazine is called The High Cost of Food Waste. If you'd like to get in on this conversation, call us now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with science journalist Elizabeth Reut. Her article in the current issue of National Geographic magazine is called The High Cost of Food Waste. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. Elizabeth, it would seem that mislabeled produce would be just ripe for sharing with food pantries and soup kitchens, or even, you know, daring consumers who would be willing to accept a bag of arugula marked as a bag of lettuce. Have there been efforts to do this, or is the stuff that is perfectly edible maybe mixed in with something that seems contaminated in some way, or really would be unacceptable?
Yes. So in the Salinas Valley, it's, you know, the salad bowl of the nation. They grow about 70% of the leafy greens that are sold at U.S. markets. And they have a pretty sophisticated system of moving produce that can't be sold to food banks. But food banks, this stuff is perishable, and the food banks need to have refrigeration and a lot of space. And there are pantries also that would take this stuff. But there's all these logistical problems getting this food to someone in a refrigerated truck, getting it there when someone is working, when the place is open, and having sometimes too small an amount can't be received, and sometimes too large an amount can't be received. So there's all these little snags, logistical problems that need to be worked out. But still, California farmers are moving huge quantities of fresh food to food banks all the time. But, I mean, it's actually... So in my story, I was talking about that transfer station, and in the growing season, they receive 4 to 8 million pounds of vegetables straight from the fields that are in the pink of health, as they say. But that's really nothing. It's nothing compared to what's available out there.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak to Yvette in Richardson. Hi, Yvette.
Hi. Something that has disturbed me for a number of years, and all I've gotten is humorous comments from store managers, is the fact that they sprinkle vegetables in the produce department, and it, number one, if it's sold by the pound, it makes them heavier, and more importantly, when they keep them wet, they get slimy and they rot, and you bring them home, and a lettuce is good for a couple of days because it's soaked through and through, which it never should be. It should just be refrigerated. And so then you have to go back in a couple of days and buy another one. And I think they do it deliberately just so they can throw stuff out, or you can throw your stuff out and come back and buy some more.
I share that frustration, so I'm glad you brought that up, Yvette. What do you know about that, Elizabeth?
I don't know that much about it, but I think they miss the food to keep it looking good, that it looks glistening and green. And if they didn't, it would look dry and be curling up. So they have good reasons for doing it. I hadn't thought about the buying by weight issue.
Yeah, I know. That's a new thing to be frustrated by. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also email think@kera.org. We had a question from Skip about how the USDA is determining household food waste. Are they doing surveys or actually measuring trash?
Some people do measure trash. There have been some university programs. They have students going out and doing waste sorts. But they also do a lot of just asking people. And I think there's some built-in assumptions about their levels of underestimating. So they know exactly what's produced on farms in the U.S. because there's a lot of reporting there. So they start with the big food pile, and then they know what people are eating, and that's another formula for coming up with loss. But it's all self-reporting on what they're eating and throwing away. So then they try to make them jibe.
So there's this question of leftovers at restaurants, and some people take them home and eat them next meal, and some people really don't want those leftovers, and those they have to get dumped in the trash, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Some people don't want the leftovers and leave them. Some people say they want them and the doggy bag comes and then they forget the doggy bag. And some people remember the doggy bag, bring it home, but then forget it at the back of the refrigerator, usually because it's opaque and they can't see it. And I think we need to have more transparent containers. That would be one fix. And some restaurants were experimenting with charging people who left food on their plates, who overordered. And others overseas have tried banning diners who repeatedly came in, ordered a lot of food, and left it on their plates.
Wow. That seems like that would be hard to make happen in this country, but it does seem like an idea worth exploring.
People have tried it, and also some restaurants have tried giving a discount to people who come. They're more interested in the packaging on the food. They give discounts to people who bring their own take-home containers. Those people are really committed to not generating more waste. They bring their own and also eating their food. So those are good customers to have. But the restaurants try it for a while and then they give it up. And it's something that it's like they're making a rhetorical point. They're trying to raise awareness and then they go back to their normal ways.
I was not aware that a lot of there are some buffets that at the end of the day, even after stocking the buffet and keeping it sort of well supplied, they have to throw out what's there.
Yes. Not only do they throw out what's been out for 4 hours, every 4 hours it has to be turned over, but because they like to keep the trays full right up until closing, if your restaurant's closing at 12 and you've got a buffet, it's got to be full at 5 of 12. You put out more food, the clock ticks midnight, and all of that gets dumped, even though it just came out of the oven or just went out on display.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to James in Fort Worth. Hi, James.
Yeah, my question was in reference to the waste in the restaurant business. In addition to what gets thrown away at the plate, is there any way you can get your company involved in composting with the stuff that comes out of the back and possibly the stuff that comes off the plates?
Yeah, a lot of restaurants are getting into that because the cost of hauling food to landfills is going up, and there's also much more awareness about how bad for the environment it is to bury organic material in landfills where it decomposes and generates methane, which is a potent greenhouse gas. So restaurants are trying to do the right thing. So first of all, they're measuring more what they're wasting. They don't want to buy more food than they can sell. So there's all kinds of new metrics and computer programs that help them get their ordering in line with what they're actually serving. And many more restaurants across the country are finding companies to haul their food scraps to a composter or to someone who will digest it and derive energy from the food waste.
And restaurants don't seem to pay a major price, those that have experimented with smaller portions.
No, and that the chain TGI Fridays has a menu with regular and then smaller portions, and people like it. A lot of people would happily pay less to get the right amount of food instead of overpaying and having it go to waste.
We have an email here from Linda in Denton who asks if you have some tips on preventing food waste in the home. She says, it's just my husband and me, and sometimes you can only get perishable items in large quantities. Is freezing the only option?
Ah, great question. I'm happy to address this. There's lots of things people can do to reduce their food waste. One is to plan your menus carefully and then to go shopping and stick to your shopping list and buy the food that you're going to eat and then eat the food that you have bought. If you can only buy in large bags, you can make meals and then freeze the whole meal. You can chop up all those peppers and freeze them on their own and use them in omelets or whatever. You can freeze fruit for smoothies. There's also pickling and fermenting and making vegetable stocks. And some people advocate a return to teaching home economics in our schools because people have forgotten how to cook, how to repurpose food, and how to take care of the food they've bought with all these other ways of extending the food's life, pickling and processing it.
I think that's a great idea, as long as both boys and girls take home economics. It's important
for
everybody.
Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Michaela in Dallas. Hi, Michaela.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. Basically, the way I see it is a basic solution. Why don't the big, large corporation who are the, grocery stores or food providers, why don't they grow foods in the areas of where the famine is? Where people are starving, and teach them how to manage, to learn how to grow something, how to prepare it, and this would not happen. At least we would kill half of it probably. But then again, if we're talking about in our country, well, there are many things that have already been mentioned. Forget about the charging people for leftover foods in restaurants. restaurants, are we talking about small restaurants or are we talking about the franchise? Franchise, you know, that's not going to happen. The small restaurant, it probably will happen where they can make smaller portions.
Well, what do you think about all that? Anything that you want to respond to, Elizabeth?
The part about large corporations growing food in the developing world where there's more hungry people, actually large corporations and investors are buying up huge swaths of land in Africa and Asia to grow food. It's a sort of colonialism. They're growing this food for export to first world countries that can pay the prices for, you know, fancy tiny vegetables and things like that. And that is a real problem because it's taking land from smallholders who are growing food to, you know, to support themselves or to send small amounts to market. Yeah, I think what we can do in developing worlds is help people take care of the food that they're growing and get it to market and share it equitably. There's huge gains to be made there, and people are working on that.
It does seem that if we could eliminate this vast amount of food waste, we could stop producing at the level we have been without having people, you know, be forced to go hungry and save some of the land and the other resources that are required to produce all this food.
Exactly. That is the sort of glaring discrepancy here is we have all these hungry people. We have enough food to feed 3 billion extra people on the planet right now. Actually, one researcher says we grow enough food now to feed 12 billion people. We just have problems getting it in good shape at a good price to the people who need it. And knowing that that food is available means that we don't necessarily have to plow down, fill in wetlands and chop down forests to grow more food on more land using more water, more oil, more fertilizers and pesticides. We need to just make better use of the food that's already growing, that it is enough for us to take care of ourselves.
This is kind of a third rail question, and it doesn't come up in the article. So if you're concerned about touching it, I'll understand. But has anyone talked about the fact that many Americans, we tend to overeat? In other words, we take in far more calories than are helpful for us or than we need. Is that considered food waste? Has anyone qualified that as food waste?
I haven't heard anyone talk about calorie. I mean, if the food is going into a human being's mouth, they're not counting it as waste in this context.
So it is. It will remain a third rail issue for a while. 1-800.
Not something I covered.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Barbara in Carrollton. Hi, Barbara.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I just kind of wanted to tie in with the caller just a minute ago about restaurants and portion size. I go to restaurants and I'm frustrated because when I get an actual meal, it's so big. So I generally don't eat the portion. So I have to look at appetizers or small house salads because their salads even that they give are ginormous. So I don't know how to, you know, talk to them about can you reduce portion sizes, because the waste isn't always on the consumer. It's the restaurants that make these huge portions. And sometimes my husband and I do share portions.
Well, Elizabeth, do you know anything about how it got to be that our portions are so much bigger? Because if you, for example, I've seen, you know, articles about, you know, a McDonald's soda cup used to be 12 ounces or something, and now that would be like a child's portion.
Yeah, it's this whole supersizing movement. Morgan Spurlock made that great movie about, there's so many companies trying to differentiate themselves to stand out and to appear to be giving you value for your money. So there's not so much they can do with the food itself at the prices you're paying for. This is in chain restaurants or fast food. And so they make it larger because the cost to them of making it bigger is negligible. The labor has already gone into it. And that's the big part of the cost. But fine dining, I think that you just have to talk to restaurant managers and owners and tell them. I mean, you should definitely bring your container with you or bring home what you're not eating. And if you know the sizes are large, that's great that you can plan and to share the meal. But there should be no shame in talking to restaurant owners about what's going on and about your concerns over food waste. There's really good reasons for for you to bring it up with them.
Let's talk about some of the things that are working and making a difference here. A really clever nudge is being used at some college cafeterias. Tell us about that.
Sure. Dozens of campuses, first of all, they started thinking about food waste for various reasons. They started measuring it and then trying to think about ways to reduce it. College students go down a buffet line with a tray and a bunch of plates, and everything looks good, and they've already paid for it, so they load up, and they end up trashing 30% of what they put on the trays. So someone came up with the idea of, let's take away the tray. If they, they'll then have, they've got their two hands, and they can have two plates or one plate and a drink. They're taking a lot less food, and they're wasting a lot less food. I think waste was cut. It's in my story, and now I can't find it. 30 or 40% less waste in those cafeterias. And if people want more food, they just get back in line and fill up another plate. But it has cut the over-serving.
And it seems like just such an obvious thing. I guess it takes people acknowledging that the problem exists to look for solutions.
Exactly. It's sort of a hidden problem, like garbage, yeah. Anyway, because, you know, we put things in the trash can and the trash is taken away. We put food in the trash can and we're not... There's no reason for us to be measuring it. But if you looked at it and if you understood that a family of four in the U.S. throws away $1,400 worth of food every year, that's real money. You know, if you start thinking of it as money, forget about all the environmental bads that are going along with it. That's reason enough to start to be more careful.
We're speaking this hour with science journalist Elizabeth Reut. Her article in the current issue of National Geographic magazine is called The High Cost of Food Waste. We'll resume our conversation, and we'd love to hear from you. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Elizabeth Reut, the science journalist, is with us this hour talking about her her story in the current issue of National Geographic called The High Cost of Food Waste. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. I love this, Elizabeth. Walmart grocery stores have figured out the solution to an age-old problem that it's great, but frankly, someone should have figured out the solution to the problem of one broken egg a long time ago.
Yeah, Walmart was, when they had one broken egg in a dozen, they would dump the whole dozen because it just took too long to find another egg that would match the age and the source of the and the size of the rest of the other 11 eggs. And they were throwing away billions of eggs a year. And then they came upon this idea of etching, using a laser to etch the date and the source and the size onto each egg so that they can very easily and quickly substitute the 12th egg into the dozen. And they thought that if they instituted this across the nation, other stores, not just Walmart, but they would save roughly 5 billion eggs a year from being sent to the trash,
wow,
to the landfill.
And eggs are one of those things that probably last longer than the sell-by dates on them might suggest.
Yeah, the many websites are geared toward. This is a really great thing about this issue, is that so many different groups have gotten in on this, and there are apps that tell you how long things will last and how to freeze things. The NRDC has some of this material, the USDA, and you can go onto the National Geographic website. There's a lot of information there that will help people take care of their food better. But I don't remember the exact number of days or even weeks that you can keep eggs, but it's much longer than you would think, or the date on the box suggests.
I mean, remember before they had dates on them and you would just find eggs in the fridge, and I don't know that I've ever encountered a bad egg in my refrigerator.
Right. And if you're worried that you're not going to be around when for the length of the eggs, you can do things like hard boil them, and I think they last longer. So you can take care of food that's going to go bad and use it in other ways.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Nancy on the line in Plano. Hey, Nancy.
Hi. I'm so glad that you invited this guest to talk about this subject, because I've been thinking about this for a long time. I have lived in Europe, and it's totally different over there. They don't waste a lot of food, because food is very expensive over there. So is water, you know, and most people drink the bottled water over there. So, you know, you pay a lot for your food. And so the portions here are just, in contrast, are huge in restaurants. And I have approached management and asked them about the portions and asked them, why couldn't they give us less? And I still think they can keep the same price. And I would think most people would go along with that. And they told me, oh, no. They said they tried, and they said people complained. They noticed that right away, that the portions were reduced, and the people complained about it. So they didn't want people complaining, so they went back to giving them large portions.
Hmm. Maybe not surprising, Elizabeth?
Yeah, I'm not surprised. I also would balk at paying, I don't know, if some pasta dish costs $18, which I think is high, and then they shrunk it, I'd be really mad, even though I didn't want to eat the giant portion. So I think it's a matter of marketing and putting the right spin on it. You don't call it a shrunken portion or a portion for little people. You call it you just need some clever name to call the more petite portion. It's just, there's a lot of clever marketing people out there, and people would be happy to pay less for less food.
1-800-933. You can always buy more, right? If you're still hungry, you can always buy more.
It's everywhere. Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Bonnie on the line in Terrell. Hey, Bonnie.
Hi. I'm so happy you talked about the date on packages. My sister is obsessive about the date on packages. She's thrown out prosciutto that was unopened because she had it until the date showed up on the package. She's thrown out 5 pounds of wild rice unopened that she had for a year. And also for eggs, Mother Earth News has a really great article on the preservation of eggs and the whole thing. Otherwise, it would take me 15 minutes to explain it.
Well, that's good to know, Bonnie. And thanks. It sounds like maybe you just need to show up at your sister's on the day that her food expires, and you
it
can
doesn't work. She insists that I'm not clean.
That makes me want to cry. I mean, it's just, I feel like we're so spoiled, and it's not about you. She's not going to get sick from that food. Will she give it to you? I mean, please move it to someone who's willing to eat it. There are plenty of hungry people out there, or budget-strapped people who would be happy to get rice unopened, no matter how old.
It lasts for lots more than a year, I think.
Yeah.
Let's go. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Prosciutto is already cured, isn't it? Isn't that the point of curing meat, is that it lasts for a very, very long time?
Especially unopened. But none of this is medical advice, by the way. I don't actually know how long prosciutto lasts, but it's worth investigating. Let's go to Robert in Fort Worth. Hello, Robert.
Hi. Just like say, great being on your show. I listen to it all the time.
Thanks.
And my comment was essentially that I don't believe it's totally the individual's fault, that you have to look at our culture of consumerism and social engineering, just the way that we're kind of prompted to consume as much as we do.
What do you think, Elizabeth?
Absolutely. Yes, we are brought up to think that deserve a never-ending abundance of perfectly shaped food. There's this, you know, the good food movement has done a lot of wonderful things, but we now have all these cooking shows and magazines that have made food into like an area of porn, and we expect perfection and pneumatically perfectly shaped vegetables and fruits. And yeah, food is, it's everywhere, 24 hours a day. It's available. It's incredibly cheap compared to other nations. Americans spend only 10% of their income on food. That's the lowest in the world, the lowest percentage in the world. So we're spoiled, and it's marketed toward us. We're molded to think that we deserve all this and we should try all these things. And yeah, people with less money are much more careful with their food. They shop more often. They shop for exactly what they're going to eat, and they waste very, very little of it.
Does the food that we buy processed, is it more likely to use these imperfect bits of produce? So for example, if I buy canned tomatoes or frozen strawberries, are they more likely to have been bruised and maybe turned into something that we as consumers consider acceptable?
Yes. Those are called secondary markets. And when farmers can't find a market for their pears or their apples, they will, if they can't find a high paying market, they still want to, if the price is still right for them to pay to get the fruit out of the field, they will send it to someone who trim the bruises and can it or freeze it. And supermarkets do this too. There's a lot of culling in the produce aisle, but if the store sells prepared meals, they'll often take the bruised yellow pepper and orange pepper and trim off a little bit of it and then cut it up and put it in their pasta salad or use it in the tomato sauce. Tomatoes go, they're called seconds. They go into tomato sauces. Apples go into juice, and that is a great use for them.
Finally, some good use for processed food. It's good to know there's something out
right.
there. Let's go next on the phone to Bob in Fort Worth. Hi, Bob.
Hello. I don't know quite how to broach this, but I was just talking about this with my 92-year-old father like yesterday. And my idea is, what are the barriers to someone, other than the logistics, I guess, to an organization or someone putting together an operation where they take the leftover food at restaurants at the end of the day? I'm talking about not food that's been served to people, but I'm talking about prepared food that in the management's opinion or in the server's opinion are suitable for their own family or for themselves, and then developing a strategy to freeze that, label it, date it, so on and so forth, and then distribute that to people in our own country or elsewhere. There's a whole lot of waste going on at that level that you know that when the end of the day is gone or the end of the shift, they just throw out tons of food.
I haven't heard about that, taking prepared foods and trying to freeze them for distribution.
It is done. You need look no farther than City Harvest in New York, which collects food from restaurants and caterers and moves it to pantries and food banks and delivers it to people in homes, I think. It's very complicated. You need to have a lot of trucks that are refrigerated, and you need to be able to pick up this food when the restaurants are done with it at the end of the night and then get it to people, as I said earlier, but to get it to people when they can receive it and then have it distributed. And there's certain things that don't travel well, and there's certain things that food banks and pantries don't want. They're always getting way too much bread and pastry products, and they're really looking for fresh produce, and they're looking for protein. So they're very happy to receive this. And it's a huge program in New York. I wish I had some stats on it, but you can look at them online. And I don't know if they're a model for other cities, but they're very successful. They've been doing this for a couple decades. And I think it would be great if other cities followed suit.
Let's go on the phone now to Tim in Dallas. Hello, Tim.
Hey there. Great program as always. So my kind of thought and question listening to all this revolves around the idea of freedom. So when you start talking about the idea of taking away a consumer's choice for ordering enormous, ridiculously oversized, you know, plates of food from a restaurant or what have you. I just wonder if you have, you know, had the experience where you come up against an argument where, well, you know, you may disagree with how I eat and how wasteful it is and what have you, but this is America, and this is this, we live in a free country, and I can eat, you know, any way that I choose.
Yeah, people do feel that way, and I suppose they're paying for the food and they can leave it on the plate if they want to. But I think this is the role of the media and these environmental groups and anyone involved in food who cares about food and the environment to raise awareness. I think a lot of people really don't know what the high cost of wasted food is, both, you know, to their pocketbook and to the environment and to other hungry people who could be using the food that you left on your plate and is now headed to a landfill. So there's there's a lot of room for raising awareness, and all we can do is keep educating people and hope that they'll make better decisions the next time someone... I mean, we're not talking about taking away someone's right to order large. it's just offering more choices for those who prefer something smaller.
Do you think, in your experience, do people's attitudes about food waste and the importance of preventing that, does that go back to, like, their family of origin, or is it something that people just sort of develop on their own one way or another once they reach adulthood?
You mean how they feel about the food they're wasting?
How they feel about whether avoiding food waste is a priority. Does that go back to the way you were raised?
Oh, I think we were probably all raised in this country with this idea that wasting food is morally wrong, but, you know, how is that enforced? And I think most people don't really know. They think they're not wasting food, and they are. But older people, especially people who lived through the Depression, are very get very excited about this issue because they know what hardship is. They know how to save food. They know how to buy properly and to store food and to eat every little bit. And so I'm sorry, we're losing these, you know, that generation. So it's up to us to educate the people coming up what these real costs are.
Do you think we've reached a critical turning point to the extent that this has become a concern for a greater percentage of Americans?
Yeah, I do feel hopeful about it. I think that it's this economic issue, with awareness of climate change and how it's going to reduce yields of food, and we're just running into all these constraints, the drought in California, it may not be possible to grow so much food in the future. So we need to do more with what we've already got, and also raising awareness back to climate change. Food waste, if you aggregated all the greenhouse gas emissions from food wasted around the globe, food waste would be the third largest emitter after China and the United States. So when you think about these negative externalities downstream after we waste food and upstream in making all the food that isn't eaten, more people... So, what I'm trying to say is there are a lot of points of entry, a lot of places where we can talk to people about why food waste is bad, why it's a problem, and how they can get involved and what we can all do.
Elizabeth Royd is a science journalist who wrote a story for the current issue of National Geographic magazine called The High Cost of Food Waste. Elizabeth, it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thanks for having me on.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Ulsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.